Good evening, everybody. We've been having a good time tasting Uchiyama Roshi as he weaves his way through Dogen in his simple way. It's very encouraging to me. I'm not a very complicated person, and it's so refreshing. He talks about his life and his mistakes and his understanding, which is not very esoteric. It's just about right now and right here. Even though the chapter that we have today is called The True Form of the Self, which sounds very esoteric, actually. True form of the self, what is that? That could be some very strange and remarkable thing. Something out there or in here or... What is it? What is the self? So he reminds us that in the Genjo Koan it says to study our Buddha way is studying the self. And the only possible way of doing that is in sitting. It can't be figured out. Our self is not a thought. It's an activity and a life. We're so well trained in thinking. We're so good at it. We've all won prizes of one kind or another. We've all gotten A's and B's and C's in thinking and filled out all the forms and written all the essays and done all the things we needed to do. But there's a whole nother aspect of us, each one of us, that isn't in that realm, that isn't controlled by that realm. And so to connect with it, we submit ourselves to ourselves. We surrender ourselves as we sit on the cushion. We abandon our desire to control what can't be controlled. And it helps a lot just to admit that we don't know. Even though it's scary sometimes. We try to know, but ultimately, we don't. He has an example, Uchiyama Roshi, of advice column in the newspapers. That's how he kept up with things. He always read at least one or two newspapers every single day, so he knew what was happening in the world around him. And he says, my present marriage is an arranged one, but recently I've really fallen in love with a girl where I work. I'm in love for the first time and want to marry her. Please tell me what I should do, unquote. He said, people often whine about some ridiculous problem like this, says Uchiyama Roshi. Perhaps, he says, I give the impression that I have not, but that is not the case. When I was young, I suffered over this same kind of problem. So I am not making fun of anyone. I anguished terribly over a similar sort of thing and wound up killing two women in my life of whining. He said, because I suffered that kind of anguish, I came to realize that the problem lies in the area of the word really, in the phrase, I really have fallen in love. He said, it's not valid to equate a fact, as real as it may seem to be, with the truth. It's just self-deception. And we deceive ourselves by believing that a fact existing in our minds is absolute truth. And in this particular time in our lives, where there is so much contention going on in our world, we can see it so clearly, how firmly people believe what they think, and how tightly those ideas are clung to, and what a mess it makes often, because so much of it sounds like a fact but isn't true. It's a lot of it is just blather. We say, oh, it's black, it's got to be black, I know it's black. Everybody knows it's black. And those people who think it's white, they're all wrong. And they're bad people because they don't see it's black. They're horrible people, and we have to get rid of them. And it can escalate into blood and guts and grief and terror and everything that is possible for animals who have no self-control at all. So it's a very serious matter, really, understanding the difference between a fact and what is true. Why is it that these differences occur? Basically, it is because we latch on to some idea as a reality and deceive ourselves into believing this reality to be the absolute truth. In meeting a particular situation, it would be fine if the same thoughts came into everybody's mind. But that's not the case. Just as one person's face is different from another's, it is only natural that the ideas which arise in everyone's minds are bound to be various. But if we become overly attached to our ideas and proceed to take them for examples of an unchallengeable truth, the inevitable consequence will be a clash of ideas that could end in war. And of course, he lived through that. He lived in an era when his government decided to make war, hideous war, first on the Chinese and then on us. He said, the fact that we are all just ordinary people is really the closest to the truth. That's why I like him so much. I just think that's so refreshing. That's a fact, but that's also a truth. We're just ordinary people. I read in the magazine an interview that a writer gave to President Obama. I've forgotten her name now. You probably know it. Marilyn. She's written some very marvelous books. And she admired him so much that, and he admired her work so much that when he came to Iowa, where she lives, he just asked to see her. And it's now a podcast of a long conversation that they had about life and truth and ordinariness. And even though he's the president, the way that she was able to be with him was just in the way that Uchiyama Roshi is talking about. Very honest and very clear and very straightforward and very accepting. Not trying to get anything from him or to try to be something special from him, but just to share ideas and feelings about how life is going, how hard it is. Uchiyama Roshi says, in Buddhism, sanity means to live without losing sight of the true form of the self. Without losing sight of, or sound, or smell, or taste, or touch of this very life body. This very one that only each one of us gets to be. He says, usually we go around getting all excited over the thoughts and feelings that fill our minds. And don't they ever? He says, when we do zazen, we let go of all that and gain a freshness, a true sanity. That alone is the true form of the self. When we practice zazen, we have to let go of those ideas that arise, regardless of how frightening or grandiose they might be. In doing so, our true form manifests itself naturally. In the Tenzo Kyokun, this is considered, referred to as magnanimous, or big mind. So in terms of ordinariness, one could say that small mind is selfish mind, of wanting more. And big mind is simply a generous, broad mind, a magnanimous mind, one that can take in and hold more than just one point of view, that sees all the colors, all the sides, and of course has a point of view. We always have a point of view. It's important to have one, to be very, very discriminating and choose carefully, but don't hold too tight to any of it, because none of it is fixed unless you fix it yourself. Everything that we hold dear is changing right in front of our eyes. Right in the middle of our life is all changing. And the more we resist it, the more we cling to our belief system, the more grief we feel, the more anguish, as he says. He says, in Buddhism, when the term dai or big is used, it never means big and compared to small. If we think of big in that way, it becomes only a relative comparison that reveals nothing about what big really is. Big is so big. And then he uses a very gentlemanly comparison. He says, compared with an electron, for example, a flea's balls are enormous. But comparing them to a whale, the whale is much obviously larger. He was a student of Kodo Sawaki, so he was bound to say things like this. He says, is the universe then the biggest thing? Hardly, since the scale of the universe as the largest entity is nothing more than an idea. And what are we human beings but a kind of fungus that lives on the surface of the earth? So what is big? What is small? He says, as long as we continue to make intellectual comparisons, there's no way of telling what big is. So he says, it means stop making comparisons of what is big and what is small. Let go of the idea of it. And suddenly everything gets big. It's the ideas that shrink our life. Sometimes to a very, very narrow little room. He says at the same time it also means to stop thinking only in terms of black, white, love, hate, right, wrong, good, evil, heaven, hell, enlightenment, delusion. In other words, big means to no longer engage in or pay heed to discriminated thought. We do think all the time. And we're always making comparisons. We're always trying to figure everything out. We have to. We're navigating through a very complicated world. And yet, if we believe all this business that's going on in our mind continually from we don't know where, it's really a kind of an arbitrary visitation from we don't know where. It's just coming through us all the time. We have a choice what to do with it. And that's our job, is to understand how it operates so that we're not locking ourselves up in a tiny room with our thoughts. And just letting them come and letting them go. Keeping the good ones until they're not good anymore. And dropping them in the face of whatever the new thing is. Embracing the new. And flowing, as Dogen says somewhere. That if we live a life flowing in time rather than stuck, with a magnanimous mind, a big mind, a generous mind, so Dogen says Zazen itself is big mind. And we feel that, certainly, when we practice together. That's one of the marvelous experiences in Sangha, that we come in all kerfluffled from whatever we're having to deal with in our work and our families and all the things that are going on. And then we sit with everybody, and when we get up, it's a very different feeling. We see each other. We feel for each other. You look at a leaf with a little bit of rain on it, and it just seems like a marvelous thing suddenly. That's what Dogen and Uchiyama Roshi are pointing to. That's our nature. That's our reality. says, how can we call people anything but senile whose thinking is so hardened that they believe their own ideas of good or evil are irrefutable and become so entrenched in their own way of thinking that they become buried under it? Zazen takes this senile mind, this narrow mind of ours that constantly discriminates between good and evil, and throws it away. It makes the mind more flexible and capable of seeing from a broader perspective. Zazen makes the mind like a high mountain and a great ocean. So, are there comments? Discussion? Paul?
Something you said reminded me of a conversation I had with my wife. The complexity of our society. We are marginalizing more and more people.
Yes.
Because the society is becoming too complex. And more and more people are becoming unable to function successfully.
It's true. You have to know how to do computers now, or you just can't manage. You have to know how to navigate through the whole insurance thing that I've been trying to figure out, that all of us old people have to deal with. And it's way too complicated for ordinary people to have to be able to deal with. We're not trained for it. You know, when we go to college to go, you know, learn physics and philosophy and history and those things, but none of us were ever taught computers and business and all the things that are now. So it's true. It's very, very complicated. But still, some people embrace it and just go for it anyway. Or find some way of living with it without...
It does breed a group of technicians and experts. You'll find tax lawyers, insurance lawyers.
Yes.
Somebody who will do it for money.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Life is complex. I mean, even living out in the country and running a farm is very complicated business also. And was 100 years ago and was 1,000 years ago. I think every moment we have a challenge trying to face what we're facing and understand where our place is in it, and hold our place in a way that's strong and has integrity and yet is broad-minded, is generous, magnanimous at the same time. Whatever we're dealing with, it's always something. If we're in a situation where we're not dealing with something, it's so rare that it's almost scary. You think, oh, what's coming next? know, this always happens. And there's the talk about how big everything is, and there's nothing to say. It's too big.
Well, I have a question about whether he equates ordinary mind with big mind or broad mind. Because I don't usually make that comparison, right? I don't think of ordinary mind as being...
I think in this in the context of this talk, he was using ordinary mind as just this very one that we are, mm-hmm. which includes, of course, big mind. Sometimes Dogen uses it to say ordinary mind or idiot people, and they should get it together and think more clearly or something, but I don't think that's what Uchiyama Roshi means. I think ordinary is just what we get. As Dogen says so many times, we're splashed with water and soaked with mud. We're very messy little animals on the face of the earth, and it's very helpful to admit that and accept it. And allow ourselves to be mistaken, and allow others to be mistaken. That nobody knows very well what they're doing. We're all blundering, and almost everybody is trying really, really hard to do the right thing. Even those who look like they're idiots are still trying really, really hard, whatever they're doing. And I think it helps to appreciate that, because that's what we're doing too. Even though so often we're idiotic and we just don't know. So we can kind of, it's okay. It's all right. You screwed up one more time. But it's all right. It's over. Something new is going to happen. Always does. Great.
So, I find, you know, talking about that bigness actually, in some ways, like, brought the human self forward for me. And so one of the things that I feel like I'm facing right now, being a woman's body and being 39, and just this question around having a baby, and I for a long time have been really committed to not doing that because I don't feel that it's what the world needs, you know? But it also feels like there's this grief, and there's this, something, there's just this longing, you know, that I come home from these talks that I was like, oh, I'm mothering the world, you know, there's this, and this whole idea, I'm taking care of everybody else's daughters, I have problems.
Yes.
But then I come home at the end of the day, and it just sometimes feels like there's something that's missing, you know?
And I do know.
I'm like, watch my sisters, my older sister, my younger sister, you know, engaged in all the trials and the wars of having children.
Yeah.
And I think that what a world to bring any life into, like, it just seems not, like, to me, unlike the Catholic Church, I think it's actually potentially selfish to have a child in this world right now because of everything that they're going to be facing, you know? And yet, you know, there's also this calling, I don't know if it's just biological.
It's powerful. Yeah? It's probably one of the more important decisions that you have to make in your life. And it's really difficult. And you can lay it all out, do a schematic, do PowerPoint presentation, this and this and this and this, but in the end, it's really up to the biggest part of you. You have to trust the biggest part of yourself. So that takes a lot of sitting, I would say, of really sitting and being, letting clarity show you how to do things, because you can't think it. And it is a powerful, powerful draw, for good reason. Well, it's about 8 o'clock. I want to remind you that there's a big do down at Redwood City on Saturday night. So everybody is invited. It's a little idea that Gil has about women and men, and so if you come, you get to watch Mahapajapati get permission to die, and then watch her as she does. So it's very dramatic.
Have you had rehearsal yet?
Yes, we've had rehearsal.
How is that going?
It's going very well. It's a little unusual, but it's a tiny stage, and there's a dancer who dances Mahapajapati as Mahapajapati is doing her old lady thing, and so the dancer doesn't have very much room. She can touch the ceiling with her hand, and it's about this wide, so it's the blocking and the staging is a challenge, but we're working it out. We're working it out.
Is it at 6:30 or 7:30?
There's a sort of reception. I think there's going to be food at 6:30 or 7, and then at 7:30, if there were a curtain, it would open. But I think we'll all be on stage at that point. 7:30.
Are there tickets or?
No.
Okay.
People are just invited to come. And the women sit in the back of the room and the men sit in the front, because 10 years ago it was the other way around. So he wanted men to experience being at the back of the bus.
And so we're separated?
Men and women are separated in the room.
Wait, the women are in the front and the men are in the back?
The other way.
Okay.
I think it's the other way. I think he's reversing it this time.
Okay.
And then he's got another little thing going, but I don't know it clearly enough to even tell you.
Huh.
And the little play takes about 20 minutes or so, so it's not a big deal. You don't have time to get bored. Are there announcements?
Well, there's also a Saturday half-day sit morning, and Angie will be her regular, ordinary self for that.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, 9 to 12.
And Judy is opening for that, and then Wendy and Ellie are gone, and there's no Kukyo for that, right? It's not the...
We chant the Heart Sutra in English, usually.
In English, and then...
That's right, we do.
The morning echo.
Yeah, great. 1 minute sit.